Hello, Word and Life. Good morning. Are you all thawing out a little bit? It was freezing out there. Goodness. Well, thanks, Tom, for that wonderful introduction. Just so you know, I'm also the senior pastor of a church here in town called First Christian Church Disciples of Christ, in the Churches of Christ tradition, in that sense. But my background's a little bit more what I like to call trans-denominational than that. Do we have anybody who's raised in a Bible-believing church in this room? Something like that, right? What about anybody who had a sort of Pentecostal upbringing? Something like that? What about Presbyterian? Any Presbyterians in here? Okay. I worked in the PCUSA for about 9 years. What about Methodists? Any Methodists in the room? Okay. That's my Claremont's a Methodist school of theology. What about Catholics? Oh, there we go. Wonderful. Nailed it. Tom says they're most in need of learning. Okay. So I'm a Franciscan at heart, too. My friends at the mission say that I'm sort of adopted Franciscan. So as you can tell, I sort of have this, I call myself maybe a theological mutt, right? And I've worked in many different traditions, and so I do see the Christian faith as one that's evolving and that has a plurality of expressions that are all beautiful in a very wide stream. So thanks for having me, and I guess this is a bit of a Word in Life baptism by fire for me, because you all assigned me 2 chapters. Am I the only speaker? I think it's got 50 pages to cover today, so it's going to be quite an adventure. All right, so we're talking today a little bit about these themes of compassionate action and mercy and forgiveness and reconciliation. And as Tom mentioned, my work is in process philosophy, and so today I wanted to start our conversation around compassion with a sort of metaphysics of compassion, and then move into discussing the God that metaphysics implies, who is also a God of compassion, and then move our conversation toward some more practical ideas of what does compassion look like in a life and in a community. So that's where we're heading today, just so you know. It's interesting to speak of compassion in 2019, I think, because predominantly we live in a society that is fragmenting, that it seems to be, from our observation, dividing at every point over political lines, over religious lines, over racial lines, over pretty much anything we can find to separate from each other. We seem to be doing that on a societal level. And so as Word in Life is a community who is self-described as a compassionate community for contemplative living and learning, I think there's a beautiful opportunity for those of us who are rallying around this cry, not only of contemplation, but of compassion, to show the world what it means to be a community that mends the fragmentation, that is a reconciling community. And so that's what we do also at the Way Collective that Tom also mentioned. We have a community that has named 5 values and practices, and the practices are connection, contemplation, curiosity, creativity, and compassionate action. So we also, we have a community that meets on Wednesday nights. We are trying to also be this force for reconciliation and love and connectivity in our world that seems to be dividing more and more. All right, so I mentioned that I want to start by justifying compassion metaphysically. So I want to take a moment to zoom out and look at a big picture description of reality, and then zoom all the way in and look at the small picture of reality, and then talk about the implications of that. So some of you might have heard of a theoretical physicist whose name is Carlo Rovelli. He's an author. And I love Rovelli because he's not a physicist who writes in such a way that the general public can't understand, but he has a very poetic voice. Not a political voice, Tom. A poetic voice in the way that he describes things. And so when we think about the big picture of the universe that we're observing these days, this is what he has to say. He says, "The world is boundless and iridescent. We want to go and see it. We are immersed in its mystery and in its beauty. And over the horizon, there is unexplored territory. The incompleteness and the uncertainty of our knowledge, our precariousness, suspended over the abyss of the immensity of what we don't know, does not render life meaningless, but rather it makes it interesting and precious." And so a couple of things I want to draw attention to here at the beginning is that you might notice that he says that the world is boundless. I think this is a way for us to describe the universe that we observe that is continually moving forward. Some of you who might be familiar with Teilhard and his work in sort of evolutionary spirituality would realize that there's an openness to the way that we observe the universe right now. And the uncertainty or the precarity that comes along with holding the future as open, Ravelli is saying here, it doesn't render life meaningless or nihilistic or anything like that. In fact, it makes it precious. It helps us to invite ourselves into adventure. And so when we think about reality in the big picture, it's one that I just want to note at the beginning is boundless and moving forward. Now, when we zoom in to look at reality in terms of quantum phenomenon and the subatomic world that we are now observing, this is what Ravelli has to say. Everything that exists is never stable and is nothing but a jump from one interaction to another. Quantum mechanics and experiments with particles have taught us that the world is a continuous, restless swarming of things. A continuous coming to light and disappearance of ephemeral entities. A set of vibrations, as in the switched-on hippie world of the 1960s. A world of happenings and not of things. Isn't that fascinating? So, what Ravelli is highlighting here is basically that even though our sensory perception of the world is one that's full of materials, right? Really hard material things that we engage with, our bodies feel that way. What he's saying is the world that we observe that's beneath that is actually not one that is made up of materiality, but rather of a sort of swarming of togetherness and what philosopher Alfred North Whitehead would call events rather than substances. And so this small picture that we see is one in which we are challenged in some of our conceptions of what it means to be a human, to be a part of nature, to be a part of this world. But the reality that I want to highlight here is that we live in a world of events, not substances. So in the same way, he extrapolates on this concept by saying that an elementary structure of the world is emerging, generated by quantum events, where time and space do not exist. Shocking, right? Quantum fields draw together space, time, matter, and light, exchanging information between one event and another. Reality is a network of granular events. The dynamic that connects them is probabilistic. Between one event and another, space, time, matter, and energy melt into a cloud of probability. Isn't that fascinating? So this world of events is one in which probability, or another way to say it would be possibility, right? Imagination is at the heart of our universe. And along these lines, Whitehead was a philosopher who was writing in the early 20th century, specifically the 20s and 30s. And he said that these events that Ravelli is describing here are what he calls actual entities, or the most real things in reality. And he said that these are actually tiny drops of something like experience or something like emotion or something like feeling, and that they're not only singular events in and of themselves, but they never exist alone. They are complex and interdependent. And so you see here that Ravelli is saying that these quantum fields somehow draw together in order to create the world that we all live in. And so I just wanted to start here with this big picture zoomed out and this small picture zoomed in to ask the question, what does this all mean? One of the things I think it means is that in our interdependence, we are literally always already feeling the feelings of others. Even though sometimes we can put walls up and sometimes we can distance ourselves, our nature is to be feeling the feelings of other creatures and our entire world. And so in our world, this is a way to affirm that relationships actually run all the way down to the bottom. And openness of the future, like we saw in the big picture from Ravelli, runs all the way down as well. So ever evolving and ever relational all the way down. And so I think that this begs the question for us this morning as we reflect upon compassionate action. What if compassion was not just an action that we showed ourselves or one another or the divine, but what if compassion was actually the basis of our entire existence? What if this feeling of the feelings of others is another way to describe the compassion of aliveness, or the compassion of becoming or being? Some of you are probably familiar with the language of non-duality, right? The non-dual, cultivating a non-dual mind, as probably exemplified most beautifully in the Christian tradition by the teachings of Jesus, but also as taught by Cynthia Bourgeau and Richard Rohr from the Center, and Ken Wilber in sort of integral philosophy teaches this as well. But non-dual is another way to talk about this ever-moving reality that we all are a part of. Non-dual meaning it's never static. Meaning the abstractions are the things that we try to pull out to look at and to observe and to say, this is it, is never really real because it always moves beyond itself. So reality, in a sense, I would also say is non-dual. So the contemplative life of cultivating a sort of non-dual inner posture and a mind and a sort of speech that speaks non-dually is right in harmony with our world. One of the other ways I think that is helpful to talk about this is mystic Julian of Norwich has this idea of oneing, of a coming together, of a unification. That this is a way to describe not only reality in a bigger picture here in 2019, but also the reality of our own existence and our relationship to the divine. And so I love that picture of oneing, but I also would want to maybe stretch it out a little bit to call it a sort of wholing. There's a wholeness to this unity that I'm trying to describe here. And this sense of wholing is that our process of becoming, that our existence as these, who are participating in a reality like the one I described, this wholeness is one in which we can actually commune with this coming together of nature, with this nature of reality that is always relational. And so when we open ourselves to that process, there's a oneing or a wholing that happens within us, and we become people who actually can, through contemplative practice, we can actually rewire our perceptual fields to experience from this place of oneness. But also, here I'm just sort of drawing this connection that I think compassion is ontologically a coming together of the fabric of reality in loving union. I'm going to say that again. Compassion is ontologically, meaning the nature of compassion, is a coming together of the fabric of reality in loving union. It's what makes us up. It's what our essence is, in that sense. And if we embrace this truth that relationships run all the way down, and that we are all always already entangled in the lives of each other and the feelings of the world around us, then we come to this place that we realize that compassion is much deeper than we might have expected. That compassion, the word literally means this sort of suffering with, right? The co and the passio, the suffering with, or you could say the feeling with, reality. And that all of this reality is at the very heart of the flow of our universe, the flow that begat us, the flow that we can participate in benevolently. And so as we think of compassion today, as at the start here, my hope is that we're not solely thinking in terms of the way that we act or we respond in our choices and our lives, but also that we realize that compassion is a part of the fabric that makes up our universe. So I want to start there and ask you all for a moment to turn to someone next to you and to ask this question. Maybe in groups of two or three if somebody's alone, but toss this question around for a couple of minutes and then we'll come back and keep going. When was a time in your life that you experienced compassion as a deeper source than just how we act toward one another? Okay, go. We'll give you a couple of minutes just to ask this question. We'll take another 30 seconds to maybe wrap up our last comments, and then we'll come back together. We could quiet our conversation. We'll come back together. Okay. All right. So when we ponder questions like this, we inevitably sort of drop into the realm of experience. And when we talk about our experiences of compassion that might run deeper than just how somebody responded to us in a time of need, we start to get into the realm of the mystical, do we not, sometimes? Sometimes we start to talk about what we might call a mystical experience or an experience of God, an experience of the divine. Maybe sometimes for us it might be a naturalism, a sort of something that we experience that as intrinsic to nature itself. And so I want to talk for this next little period of time around this implied God of compassion. So if we are in this place of metaphysically sort of trying to justify the compassionate nature of the universe, then I want to talk for a moment about God. As Mirabai's book, God of Love, is this sort of reflection and rumination on the Abrahamic conceptions of God. I think that there's something in this metaphysics of compassion that leads in that same direction. And so there's a philosopher named Maurice Merleau-Ponty who says that a given language is a particular way to sing the world. A given language is a particular way to sing the world. And I think that God is a way to sing this interconnection that I'm trying to describe. God is a way to sing this connectivity of our world. And in response to Mirabai's book, God of Love, I think now we are sort of turning to this question of who or what is this one, capital O, that the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic faiths know? Who is this one? Who is this whole, or what is this whole? And if reality is really an exercise in compassion, then God, too, I think, is another way to talk about the loving presence of our interrelationality, of our relationships, of our interdependence. God is a way to sing of sacred compassion. It's the song that we sing. It's a way for us to sing also the oneness of what philosophically might be called multiplicity, which is another way to describe this world of events. One of my favorite theologians, whose name is Catherine Keller, she says that God is the loving and just interrelationality of all relations. And I would add that God is the compassionate interrelationality of all relations. Yeah. Oh, there you go. That's called autocorrect. Some programs on the Macs don't quite know what interrelationality is, and so just dream with me that that says interrelationality. Thank you for pointing that out. So God is the loving and just, or you could say God is the compassionate interrelationality of all relations. So that's a way to say that existence has a certain quality to it. Existence is compassionate. That God, as a way to sing this presence of our world, is compassionate. And some of you might be familiar with the concept of God as immutable, or God as sometimes what is called the unmoved mover, who is sort of presiding over the world, distant and aloof, not really involved in the events, but kind of created it, set it in motion, then like pulled out, right? That is one way that some people conceive of divine reality. But what if God is, as theologian Clark Pinnock has named God, the most moved mover? The one who is most down in and through all of the relationality of our world that makes up our cosmos, that is actually the most involved and most connected and compassionate presence in our world. I think that the Bible gives us this picture of Jesus Abba in a profound way. Jesus seems to experience God as a divine parent, right? As one who is an ever-present source of blessing and compassion and withness, even as he goes through his own passion. And we know this in the Christian tradition also because steadfast love is the most common descriptor of God in the Old Testament. Whereas some of us might hear about the warrior nature of God and some of the other things or metaphors that God gets called, right? Eagle's wings, mother, some of these other beautiful metaphors in the Jewish tradition. Actually, steadfast love is the most common quality that is used to describe God in the Old Testament. One of my favorite stories from the book of Acts is the story from Acts chapter 10 where Peter has this vision as he's praying of this blanket full of food. Does anybody remember that from Acts chapter 10? Okay, you know in good Jewish tradition that there are things you can eat and there are things you cannot eat. And so Peter is sort of in this ecstatic moment and he has this vision of God in which God reveals a blanket to Peter and it's got reptiles and birds and all kinds of four-legged creatures on it. And Peter's like, this is really interesting. And he feels that the sense of this image is God saying, go kill and eat. Go kill and eat. Now, we have to realize how bonkers this would have been for Peter to hear this, because out of his own obedience to God, he would not have eaten any of these things, right? Out of the purity code that he was trained in, that he was raised in, out of his deep religiosity and his commitment to God, he was not to eat any of these things. And all of a sudden, God gives a vision of this idea that you can. There's a new command. There's something that's expanding our understanding. And in this, it kind of goes on in this little narrative, and Peter's trying to reconcile this within his own Jewish life, right? Like, how can I all of a sudden be one person who's going to eat all these things that all my other fellow people will not go near? And he ends up having this sense that he realizes that what is being communicated through this experience is that God shows no favoritism. That God shows no favoritism. Because this was not just a call for him to somehow eat the things that he couldn't any longer, but it was a call for him to sit and dine with Gentiles. It was a move out of the tribal expression of the Jewish religion toward an inclusivity of a wider love that reached outside of the bounds. Now, for those of us who are, you know, sort of hermeneutically thinking about this text today, I think there's a couple of ways that we often do it, right? Sometimes preachers or teachers might take this passage and be like, see, God was expanding the gospel outside of the Jewish tradition to include the Gentiles. And that was a one-time historic act that was a really interesting, you know, move that God made to sort of welcome this gospel to the wider world. That's one way to think of it. But I want to propose that perhaps this is the way that the tradition always moves forward, is that we're always going to be surprised by who God is loving and including and showing compassion towards beyond our tribal biases, beyond the ways that we like to other and create boundaries, right? And I think that this image is a beautiful one as we talk about this God of compassion, because that is not only the nature of the tradition, that we're always going to be asking this new question, where is God expanding our love to next? Where are the people on the margins who need to be loved? But what if that's also a way to describe this compassionate and loving relationality of God? That God is the one who is always expanding and sending love to new places as well. And so I love that story from Acts for that reason. Because God does show no favoritism. And as that chapter in Mirabai's book on mercy and forgiveness was so beautiful, I think that this divine song of compassion that I'm trying to name right now as God is one in which God is this reconciler of reality. This one who always goes after the fringes, who always brings love to new places. And so, with that framing, I want you to turn and ask this question to one another. When have you experienced compassion as a sacred source in your life? So not just where was compassion deeper than somebody's action toward you or your action, but have you ever experienced compassion as a sort of sacred or divine source in your life? Okay, take a few minutes and turn again to the same people and toss that question around, and we'll come back. We'll take about 30 seconds to wrap up our last comments. All right. Okay. Try to quiet our conversations and come back together. You know, as Tom said, there's a lot of wisdom flowing in this room right now. I don't want to stop it, but thank you. Beautiful. Okay. So, as we reflect on this topic of divine compassion, or the sacred source of compassion, we talked about just a moment ago how God is this sort of reconciler of reality. As we turn toward having a small discussion around what compassion looks like in action and what the sort of practical expression of this can be in not only our individual lives but our communal lives, I'm reminded of this call from 2 Corinthians that Paul writes in his letter in chapter 5, starting in verse 17, says this. So if anyone is in Christ, there is a new creation. Everything old has passed away. See, everything has become new. All this is from God, who reconciled us to God's self through Christ, and has given us the ministry of reconciliation. That is, in Christ, God was reconciling the world to God's self, not counting their trespasses against them, and entrusting the message of reconciliation to us. So we are ambassadors for Christ, since God is making God's appeal through us. We entreat you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. Be reconciled to God. So, I would argue that this truth, or this call that Paul is naming here, actually goes deeper, that we are all already always reconciled to God, and yet there's something in which we have a choice of turning toward that reconciliation, right? We have a choice of participating in it. We have the choice to let that flow be done in us and to walk in that path. And I love this idea because, as you all, I'm sure, well know, many of you are my elders. I don't know if there's any... let's see. Anyone my age in here? Yeah. There you go. The fruit of the contemplative life is compassionate outflow. The fruit of connection and reconciliation and turning toward this path is compassionate outflow. And, you know, I love that Mirabai in this book, God of Love, said that all the religions of the world seem to hold compassionate action as their highest ideal. She names this, and obviously she's reflecting again on the Abrahamic traditions here, but there is something about this compassionate outflow that is a part of the deeper levels of any religious path. And she also brings to mind in this book this idea of turning. So we just talked about this turning toward that sacred compassion, or that divine compassion that's always already reconciling you, always already a part of you. And this is a little Rosh Hashanah chant that she mentioned. She says, return again, return again. Return to the land of your soul. Return to who you are. Return to what you are. Return to where you are born and reborn again. And as she sort of parses this chant out in her book, she names this idea of teshuva, or might be for us this word repentance, which really, even in the Greek form of that in the New Testament, means this turning. Or sometimes there's a connotation of changing of a mind, or a turning of our thoughts into a new direction. Or as Richard Rohr would say, even putting on a new mind, right? So this is something that we have an invitation to cultivate in ourselves, in our contemplative lives. But that this reorienting, or this repentance, or this returning to this reconciliatory and compassionate sacred source is one that doesn't stop there. It moves us into the world to be compassionate people, or to be, as Paul said, ministers of reconciliation, people who extend that hand. And there's always this dance between action and contemplation that I know you all are familiar with, so I don't need to elaborate very much on that. But what I want to say is that they are always already intrinsically connected. I don't know if you're picking up on a theme yet, right? They're always already intrinsically connected. And that we have periods in our life and our rhythms of life where we have to take note of and cultivate and care for both our contemplative lives and the lives that we extend out into the world in action. And so in contemplation, in this sense, if we connect to a sacred source of compassion, then this inevitably leads us to act compassionately in our lives. Now, for a moment, as we think about what this means, I want to draw a point of difference between compassion and empathy. Because I think sometimes when we think of those two terms, we sort of think they're synonyms, maybe they mean the same thing. But in reality, they're actually quite different. And so we need to understand at the outset here that compassion is not empathy. Compassion is not empathy. In fact, empathy by itself is something that can be sort of confused with a feeling of compassion, right? But in a sense, empathy is being moved and taking on and feeling the feelings of another person. So as we said, that's sort of part of our nature. It's what we're wired for. It's that nature of our reality. And Tanya Singer, who's the world's leading expert on empathy, she says that empathy is the impulse of "I feel your pain." Right, so when we stumble upon a wounded creature in nature and you feel the heart tug, I feel that creature's pain. When a loved one falls ill and you spend time beside their bed and you see that they're suffering and you feel that suffering too, right? That's empathy. That's natural. It's normal. It's good. But we often confuse empathy with compassion. And so even Tanya Singer did when she first started to do sort of neurobiological studies on this. And so what ended up happening was that she thought compassion was really just empathy in relationship to suffering, right? This sort of empathic feeling. So what she did was she got Matthew Ricard, who's a Buddhist monk, to be brain monitored as he cultivated compassion in meditation through a Buddhist compassion meditation. And the interesting thing for her was that compassion did not light up the study like when he was doing the meditation. It didn't light up the region of the brain that she thought it was going to. In fact, it didn't do that at all. Instead, when he felt empathy, his brain lit up. So when she said, okay, now cultivate some empathy, and he was thinking of some of those people or creatures that he had felt seen hurting and in pain and cultivated that empathic impulse, his brain did light up. So, but he didn't want to be left there. What he realized was, you can't now just leave me after feeling this empathy. Now I need to go back and cultivate a little compassion. And so the part of the brain that lit up when he did compassionate meditation was the part that oxytocin comes from, was the part that oxytocin is like the deepest feeling when a mother has given birth right afterwards, right? This feeling of love and pure bliss and sort of connectivity, even in and through and after the pain. Oxytocin is when two partners fall in love, right? And that sort of mutuality, it's a renewing, regenerating, sustaining emotion that is actually the antidote to empathy. That's what compassion is. And part of my doctorate at Claremont was in this thing called the compassion practice, which I'm going to teach you all about here in a moment. But I want to mention that all this research is coming from Dr. Frank Rogers, Jr. So I'm not just, not giving credit where credit is due. But this idea that compassion is actually an oxytocin release, that it's renewing and regenerating and sustaining, we realize then if we stay in empathy, we take on others' pain and it releases cortisol in our brain. It actually releases, which is stressful and debilitating and puts us in fight or flight, right? It actually hurts us because empathy hurts, because pain is painful, And so it makes emotional regulation more difficult when this empathy is being expressed, when the cortisol is being released. It makes us less available. It makes us prone to burnout. It makes us numb out if we feel too much of it. How many of you all might have what is often called compassion fatigue? I've heard this phrase before. But really what it is empathic fatigue, right? I think many of us just being exposed to the news these days in our country have this empathic fatigue. the rise of anxiety, of panic attacks, of depression, given the state of things that we are constantly being exposed to, this is what is happening. It's empathy fatigue or empathic disorder fatigue. And so this is important for us, I think, because we're all naturally empathic people. And yet the call is beyond empathy to cultivate a sense of compassion. So compassion is really allowing that empathic connection to develop just enough to feel the suffering, to feel the pain, but then transforming that feeling into a warm, loving energy that is generative of compassion. And we can do this through contemplative practice. We can do this through discipline and learning to not overextend ourselves empathically. It's being connected and moved by another's experience, but not getting sucked into their experience. Does that make sense? It's accessing this loving energy and this feeling of all-accepting presence and of warmth and of care. And it's consuming that, but it's not itself empathy. It's a different orientation. So the call here is empathy, yes, but compassion after, right? I think that this resonates with the nature of this community, even though it's only my first day being with you all today, because your name is Word and Life, right? There's an author and speaker named Rob Bell who says that the Christian tradition is a flow from word to life or from word to flesh and not the other way around, right? So we need to beware of people taking the tradition in the wrong direction. This is the incarnation, right? Word to flesh. Word to life. The movement is that way. And so this idea of starting to see that compassion is a transforming practice for us that can transform our empathic distress, that can move us to places of connectivity, means that we have a call to be people who don't only sit with the contemplative word of this teaching, but also move toward an enfleshing or an embodying of that in our lives. And I think that's built into who you all are. So I'm excited about that today. So I want to just close by describing this as an overflowing of our own connectedness to the sacred source of compassion. This is our connection to love that allows us to act lovingly. It's our connection to compassion, realizing our deepest and truest nature as already connected, already tied to compassion, from which we can now live from that place where compassion is our outflow. Process theologian John Cobb says that this is what he calls secularizing our faith. Secularizing our faith. And what that means is not becoming secularists necessarily or secular humanists, but turning our attention toward the external world. Turning our care and our concern and our compassion toward the world around us. And he recommends, or his diagnosis is, that is exactly what the Christian movement needs today. It's people who are willing not to create more internal sort of facing communities or houses of faith, but rather those whose eyes are now turned toward the outer world, who is so desperately in need of this compassionate unity, so desperately in need of wholeness in a time of fragmentation. And I love that picture because I think it gives us a sort of impulse. It gives us a mission, in a sense. Not in the crusading or coercive impulse of mission, but it gives us a purpose from which to live and to engage the world around us. And I want to just name here at the end that it's easy to get overwhelmed with compassion. It's easy for us to see what's going on in our country and to think, okay, individually, I can't fix that. Or globally, there's rises of poverty and climate issues that are going to only hurt the poorest of the poor. And so we can sometimes see that and we feel the empathy and then we get overwhelmed like, what kind of compassionate response can I have that will fix anything at all? And so I want to close with this quote by Rachel Naomi Remen. Krista Tippett, who is an author and also has this podcast called On Being on NPR, I'm sure many of you are probably familiar, in her book Becoming Wise, it's a series of her own meditations on wisdom, but also in her, there's a lot of the conversations that she's had on her podcast that are sort of, that are a part of that conversation as well. And so as she's interviewing Rachel Naomi Remen, she has this little impulse that I think is such a beautiful way for us to end. She says, heal the world that touches you. Heal the world that touches you. It's not our job to heal the entire world, and to get, you know, empathic disorder fatigue, right? Instead, our only natural and connective impulse is to heal the world that touches us. And there's lots of places, I'm sure, if you all reflect on that, that the world touches us in a broken way, in a way that's frantic and disordered and full of anxiety. And the goal for those of us who are walking the contemplative path and want to have this compassionate outflow, perhaps maybe we could reframe the way we think of that in this sense. The call for each of us is to heal the world that touches us. And in that, we can try to root ourselves in love in such a way that we can also become a sort of sustaining and compassionate and healing impulse to those around us. Amen? Okay, cool. Okay, well, right now, I want you to turn and ask this question as a lead into our break. Yes, as a lead into our break. So you can do it if you want it for a couple of minutes and then go get some snacks, or during your snack break, feel free to toss this around and then we'll come back for our normal time after the hospitality break. Yeah.